newsplay property using Definite Programs.
Okay, so first, thank you very much for the invitation. And yes, I'm going to talk about tractable performance bounds for compressed sensing, even though the title is a little bit different. Hopefully that will be resolved pretty soon. And I should start by saying that this is joint work with Francis Bach and Laurent Elgaoui at Ecole Normale Supérieure in RIA and Berkeley. And I'm very grateful for support from NSF, DHS, and Google. So this is a sort of familiar theme. Now we're going to start with a highly underdetermined linear system. Okay, so we're trying to solve AX equals B. But the matrix A here is very fat, so N, the fundamental dimension here, is much larger than N. Okay, and I'm going to be a little bit more precise later on about how much larger, but right now just keep in mind that A is very fat. Okay? And in this case, we're going to be interested in the sparser solution to this linear system. Okay, so we assume that there are many solutions to AX equals B, but the one that we care about is the one with the fewest non-zero coefficients. Okay, so this is what the black spots here represent. Okay, this is not a tiger. And so, despite the resemblance. And so, why do we care? I mean, this is not strictly masochism. In signal processing, for example, you're making a few measurements on a system, and you know that in some basis that you know, this system has a sparse representation. Okay? And the key question here is how many measurements do you need to make to reconstruct this sparse vector? Okay? And typically here the basis is something well chosen, a Fourier basis or wavelet basis, etc. I'll illustrate this in a few slides. In the coding example, you're transmitting a message, and this message is corrupted, a few entries are corrupt, and you want to know at what point there is enough noise to completely lose the signal. So it's kind of clear that if there aren't too many errors, you still have a chance to reconstruct the original signal, and the key question is beyond which point do we lose the information. Okay? And in statistics, this is known as a viable selection problem or lasso, penalized least squares, penalized regression or penalized least squares. So it's a classic topic in statistics, and it's sort of directly connected. So applications here are fairly obvious. What's not so clear is why sparsity. And it turns out that in everything I'm going to say and everything I'm going to discuss, sparsity is a sort of easy proxy for power laws. Okay? And we know from various examples, actually many, many examples, that power laws appear everywhere in nature. Okay, so word frequencies in natural language follow a power law. Ranking, the page rank coefficient of a web graph follows a power law as well. In signal processing, 1/f signals. In social networks or networks in general, typically the degree of distribution of nodes follows the power law as well, earthquakes, river systems, cities, etc., etc. Just to illustrate, give you a few examples, this is the distribution of word frequencies in Wikipedia. It's being computed by Wikipedia itself, and this is in log-log scale. And you see, okay, it's not a strict power law, but it comes close enough. Okay? So, same thing. This is frequency versus magnitude for earthquakes worldwide. Okay? The data is so smooth that you even think it's false, right? And so the reference is here. I don't know. I trust these guys. But in this case, of course, these are very small earthquakes, so there's a small deviation because these become incredibly hard to measure. Okay? Because you have to stop breathing. And same thing for images. This is an original image of a painting called La Mélancolie, a gravure called La Mélancolie.
Huh?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and it's called La Mélancolie because I'm going to have a few negative results to present at the end of the talk, and so I thought this was appropriate. And so if you decompose this, you can do the experiment with five lines on MATLAB. You decompose this in a proper wavelet basis, you truncate, you keep only 9% of the wavelet coefficients, you reconstruct, and you get this. Okay? This is sort of another illustration of the fact that natural images or natural signals tend to be sparse, or at least approximately sparse. And approximately sparse for us is going to be enough. So everything I'm going to say about sparsity works for approximate sparsity as well. Okay? So just to put words into equations, the problem we're really interested in solving here is the problem of minimizing the cardinality of the vector x subject to ax is equal to b. And the cardinality here is the number of non-zero coefficients. Okay? And that's a hard, I mean, this is somewhat subjective, but at least as far as convex programming is concerned, this is a hard combinatorial problem in Rn. Okay? And so a classic heuristic several decades old is to replace the cardinality function by the L1 norm of the vector x. Okay? And so instead of solving this minimum cardinality problem, we solve the minimum, this L1 norm, so sum of absolute values of x, L1 norm minimization problem subject to the same linear constraint. And this is, it's very easy to show that this is equivalent to an easy linear program. Okay, it's convex. We have solvers that solve these things in very large dimensions. Okay, so what's the original intuition behind this relaxation? Well, this is the problem we're trying to solve. So you minimize the cardinality subject to linear constraints. And I suppose we have, for simplicity here, I'm just illustrating, suppose we have bounds on the magnitude of the coefficients of the solution, we can rewrite this problem as a 0-1 optimization problem. So provided these bounds on the solution, this problem here will give you a solution to this one. Okay, but this is a 0-1 problem in Rn, and so its complexity is potentially exponential. It's actually NP-hard. Okay? The trick here is to take the cardinality function, which is the sum of indicators, and relax it into the closest possible convex function, which in this case will be this L1 norm. Okay, and this is easy. It's easy to prove on using graphical arguments. This function here is the cardinality function in dimension 1. Okay, it's equal to 1 everywhere except in 0. And if you look at the interval -1, 1, the largest convex lower bound on this function has to be this absolute value. Okay? So geometrically, at least, in some sense, if you want the closest convex program to the original minimum cardinality problem, minimizing the L1 norm should do relatively well. Of course, this is on -1, 1, but using invariance properties and symmetry, etc., you can generalize this to Rn and even the rank function for matrices. Okay? So that's a sort of quick graphical proof, but you can actually show that, that there are many other ways to recover this L1 objective function. One is simply to say that we're going to relax the binary constraints into convex interval constraints. Another is actually to formulate the mixed integer linear program as a non-convex QP and use Lagrangian relaxation techniques. All of these turn out to be equivalent to L1, okay? Which sort of further illustrates the fact that, in some sense, L1 is the best you can do. There's an optimality about Lagrangian relaxation that shows that L1 is particularly good in this case. And again, the same trick can be generalized to, for example, minimizing the rank of the solution of a semi-definite program. The equivalent of the L1 function in this case is simply the trace norm, the sum of the singular values. Okay? So that's the intuition behind L1. Now, what's the main phenomenon we're attracted to here? Well, suppose I fix A, and I'm not saying anything about how we computed A in this case, and it's just falling from the sky at this point, but A is fixed. It has dimension 50 by 30, it's actually 30 by 50. And then basically for various values of the cardinality target K, we're going to generate sparse signals E and try and encode them using the matrix A. So what we observe now is not E but AE, which is much smaller than E. And then we're going to try to reconstruct the original signal by solving this L1 minimization problem. Okay, so we minimize the L1 norm of X subject to AX is equal to AE. And we look at the solution. Okay, and when they match, I record success. And when they don't match, I record failure, up to some numerical error, of course, but small. And so for every target cardinality between 0 and 50, I'm going to do this 100 times and record basically the probability of success for each cardinality target. And what you see now is this very striking phase transition behavior, okay? So when E, the signal, has a low cardinality, you always recover the original vector E by solving this L1 minimization problem, always, okay? Then as the cardinality of the signal increases, well, you basically recover E most of the time, so you recover E with high probability, okay? And at some point, things get really tricky. The cardinality crosses a certain threshold, let's say 20 in this case, and your chances of recovering the signal by solving this L1 minimization problem become extremely small. And of course, beyond 30 here, situation is seriously desperate, okay? This is a sense of doom, okay? The melancholy stops at 30 and doom starts there. So basically, this is the key phenomenon that we're interested in this talk, and that's been triggering this surge of interest in L1 minimization and compressed sensing in the last 5 or 6 years. Okay? So again, the key question now is, I give you a matrix A, where is this threshold where beyond which recovery, below which recovery is guaranteed? Okay? Same thing, where is this threshold where you get recovery with high probability. Okay, and well, the reason why people got interested in this L1 minimization trick is that for some matrices, we can get explicit expressions for the threshold. Okay? So in particular, Dono and Tanner in 2005 and Condes and Tao at about the same time show that for certain matrices A, when the solution E is sparse enough, the solution of the L1 minimization problem is also the sparsest solution to the linear system AX is equal to A. Okay? So you get perfect decoding. And furthermore, this happens when the cardinality of the vector E is proportional, asymptotically of course, to the number of samples you are taking, M. Okay? So M is the small dimension of the matrix. Okay, asymptotically in N when N and M grow proportionally to each other. So M is a fraction of N. Okay, and this is of course probably optimal because it's a sort of a sparse version of the traditional linear algebra result. So you're basically oversampling by a fixed factor. Okay, which is quite spectacular. There's a log term that I'm omitting, but essentially it means that the large dimension N of the space does not show up in this recovery threshold. Again, up to a log term. So you get this picture about sparse recovery, and this is a picture that I got from Jared Tanner on Gaussian matrices A, where you have essentially three regions. This is, in the x-axis, the shape of the matrix N. It's the ratio between M and N. It tells you how fat the matrix is. Okay, so in this direction, things get harder because you have fewer samples. In this direction, things get easier. And this on the y-axis is the cardinality of the solution E, okay? So essentially, things get harder when your signal has more and more non-zero coefficients. And what the results in Dono and Tanner proved on Gaussian matrices is that you actually have two explicit thresholds, one below which you always recover, again, always is almost surely asymptotically, the original signal by solving the L1 minimization problem. So here you're guaranteed to recover the original signal. When the signal becomes a little bit denser, so that it has more non-zero coefficients, you recover the signal in this region with high probability. Okay, and when you cross this threshold here, again, desperation kicks in and you lose the signal entirely. Okay? But the impressive news is first that, well, the cardinality is proportional to the number of samples, so you always oversample by a constant factor. That's very striking. And second, that you can compute these thresholds explicitly. So roughly speaking, what this tells you is that if n is twice what m is, so if basically you only observe 50% of what the problem dimension is, then if your solution has at most 10% non-zero coefficients, you're guaranteed to recover the signal by solving the L1 minimization problem. Okay? So keep that 10% number in mind. Typically what you observe though when you do these experiments is the high probability threshold. Okay? So roughly speaking, if you do these experiments on MATLAB, and this is something you can do with 5 lines of MATLAB, you're gonna get something closer to this line here, so 20%, 25%. So again, this what these results tell you is that provided A satisfies a certain number of conditions that I will discuss, then if your signal is basically 20% sparse or sparser, you're guaranteed to recover it by solving an L1 minimization problem. Okay? So there are similar results for rank minimization. The reference is here. The slides will be online. So what are these conditions? Well, there are many types of conditions. And so the ones that were used by Condest and Tao are called restricted isometry property. Okay, and actually there are also other conditions that are even much simpler in some sense that were derived by Deneau and Yeo in 2001 and that can also be found in this paper by Cohen, Damen, and DeVore. Okay, but the big news, these conditions are intuitive. There's nothing too special about them, especially the null space property. On the other hand, the really big news that sort of triggered this recent wave of interest is that we can show that random matrices, certain classes of random matrices, Gaussian, Bernoulli, et cetera, Fourier, satisfy these conditions with high probability. Okay? So we found examples of matrices A that satisfy this condition for very high values of the cardinality. Okay? So all of this would be fine, very nice. There's one small problem, which is that, well, in general, these conditions are harder to test than, for example, solving a minimum cardinality problem. So I can show you examples of matrices that will satisfy these conditions with high probability. Okay, so for pedagogical purposes, things are fine. I just generate a Gaussian matrix. However, if you give me a system matrix coming from some physical sensing system and ask me, well, this one satisfy the restricted isometry condition or the null space property, actually, there's no tractable answer to this question yet. Okay? So the key question we try to answer is, well, can you at least, using relaxation techniques, prove that some matrices, some deterministic matrices or some fixed matrices satisfy these conditions while keeping the complexity of checking these conditions low? Okay? Yes? Yeah, it's offline. And you basically check something that's valid for all vectors. You check it once and then you ship your system and it will recover, it will be guaranteed to work below a certain threshold. Exactly. Okay? So typically when you hear, you know, a message from engineers, this is what they're interested in. So it's essentially something that measures the compressed sensing performance of your system. And it actually goes further and I have a result to illustrate this. Okay, so I'm going to talk very briefly about testing the restricted isometry property. And then I'm going to talk very briefly about how we can test the null space property. And then I'll talk, and this is where the sort of melancholy kicks in, about limits of performance. Okay? So the first definition, Condest and Tao called the constant delta K of A, the restricted isometry constant of a matrix A, a constant delta that basically measures how far submatrices of size K of the original matrix A are from being isometries. Okay? So if delta was equal to zero here, every submatrix of size K of the matrix A would be an isometry. okay? And delta here is typically small and measures how far we are from this isometric scenario, okay? The very important component of this inequality is that we only look at k columns of the matrix A, okay? So it's something you enforce on sparse submatrices of the original matrix. So far, most compress sensing conditions or recovery conditions were based on the full matrix. Here, you only look at fragments, okay? But the point is that this, which really makes the result work, also makes the condition very hard to check because you have to look at every k subset of one end, okay? And so the key result, one of the key results in Condé-Centaur is to show that delta k controls sparse recovery using L1 minimization. So if you can measure delta k, you will know what kind of recovery threshold you can expect. So typically, if delta 2k of A is below 1, then you're guaranteed to recover the original vector by solving the combinatorial problem. The solution is unique, etc. And if furthermore, delta 2k of A is smaller than square root of 2 minus 1, okay, then actually solving this linear program, the L1 minimization problem, will recover the exact solution E, provided, of course, the cardinality of the vector E is smaller than k. Okay? And actually, it goes beyond that. You get this one yes-no answer on recovery. But even if recovery, exact recovery fails, you get bounds on the quality of the solution that are very striking. Okay? So suppose delta 2k is smaller than 1. Delta 2k also controls reconstruction error. Okay? When you don't have exact recovery. So in particular, if x star is the solution to the L1 minimization problem, and E is the signal you're trying to reconstruct, then the L1 reconstruction error between this solution, L1 solution and the original signal is bounded by this ratio here that's computed directly from delta 2k of A times sigma k of E. And sigma k of E is here in this case the best possible approximation error. It's the best you can do using approximating the signal E with a vector that has k non-zero coefficients. Okay? So you're guaranteed to do at least a certain multiple of the best possible reconstruction error, and this solution quality is explicitly controlled by the constant delta 2k of A. Okay? So there are actually relatively simple proofs in these two references. So now the key question is, how do we compute this quantity delta 2k of A? Well, it's relatively easy to see that this thing here, if you divide on both sides by the square norm, becomes a Rayleigh quotient. And so this looks essentially like a sparse eigenvalue. Why? Well, if you forget about the cardinality constraint, this essentially 1 plus delta k max will be the leading eigenvalue of the matrix AA transpose. Okay. The key difference here is that we're only looking at pseudo eigenvectors with k non-zero coefficients. Okay. So you're still maximizing a Rayleigh quotient, but in practice, you're also asking for the solution to be sparse. Okay. And you get a similar problem to get delta k min, and delta k is simply the max of these two quantities. Right. So. That's nice. It doesn't make things easier because this is still a highly non-convex combinatorial problem. But the good news is that we have convex relaxations for this problem. They were derived sort of by accident while we were working on another problem, which is sparse PCA. Okay, you can look at this problem as a problem of finding factors that explain a maximum amount of variance in the covariance matrix AA transpose while using as few problem variables as possible. So you're doing dimensionality reduction, you want to plot high dimensional data in a few dimensions, and you also want to do it, because of this cardinality constraint, using sparse factors, so that the interpretation of these factors is also obvious. So you're doing dimensionality reduction on both counts. Yes?
Maybe to understand this delta k, I'm not sure, but is it the same as giving uniform upper bound on the maximal singular value and uniform lower bound on the minimal singular value? For all these
sub-names,
this is when you
pick k columns. Yes.
It's exactly
the same thing. Yeah. But it's still combinatorial.
Yeah, it's the same thing.
Yes, of course. Yeah. And so the idea is that looking at this sparse CCA problem, we produced a semi-definite relaxation for the problem of computing these sparse eigenvalues. Okay? And so typically, we're going to get bounds on this quantity here, delta max, by solving a semi-definite program. So I'm just going to very quickly describe how we can do that. So this is the original problem. Okay, and we're going to use a lifting procedure that's very similar to the one used, for example, in the max cut paper by Gumans and Williamson. So you maximize a quadratic function. It's actually a convex quadratic function in this case because A, this is a bad choice of notation, A is A transpose, actually, subject to this normalization constraint and the cardinality constraint. This is non-convex in many ways. The objective you're trying to maximize is convex, so that's a problem. This is a non-convex constraint, this one too. This is bad, okay? But what we do is that we're going to change variables. We're going to use a variable, a capital X matrix variable, that's equal to XX transpose. And we're going to try to write everything in terms of the matrix X, okay? So X transpose AX is simply the trace of AX when X is defined in this way, okay? Same thing, the Euclidean norm of the vector X is simply the trace of the matrix X. Okay, so this constraint, the objective and the first constraint become linear. If the vector X has cardinality less than K, the matrix X must have cardinality less than K squared. And then finally, we have this explicit expression for the change of variable. Okay? So this is still non-convex, of course, but we can again replace X, this equality constraint, our change of variable, by constraints on the matrix X alone. Okay, so this is equivalent to X being PSD and the rank of X being equal to 1. So our problem becomes this one here, and essentially this is the same problem as the original one, it's just written in a different matrix variable. Okay? The good news is that the objective was non-convex, it's now linear. The Euclidean norm constraint on the vector X is now, again, a linear constraint on the matrix X. But it is still hard because of the cardinality constraint and, of course, the Hahn constraint. Okay? Well, we can use a classic trick for the cardinality constraint for vector U, because when the cardinality of U is equal to Q, we have this inequality between the L1 and the L2 norm. We can essentially replace or relax the cardinality constraint by a weaker but convex constraint on the sum of the absolute values of the coefficient of X, okay? So this is the notation for essentially a penalty that will make the matrix X sparse in this case, and we simply drop the Hahn constraint, which is sort of O plus, okay? So, well, if you do that, we move from this problem here. I replace this constraint by a weaker convex one. We drop the Hahn constraint, the maximum has to be higher. So this problem here, which is convex, it's a semi-definite program, always produces an upper bound on the value of this problem here. You can do the same thing for the minimization problem, computing minimum eigenvalues. And so you get bounds on delta 2k, the restricted isometric constant of the matrix A. Okay, so very briefly, because this has implicitly n square constraints on the matrix X embedded in it, the complexity of solving this using interpond methods would be n6. n6 is not particularly pleasant, but in this case, we're not interested in getting high precision solutions, so typically you can use first order methods, and the complexity of these methods tends to grow as n4 with the problem dimension. Okay? The dependence with precision is 1 over epsilon, so it's much worse than for interpond methods, but on the other hand, we're not interested in very high precision in any case. So we can test this. So we take a Gaussian matrix for which we know where the recovery thresholds are located, and we can produce bounds on delta k. And we have this threshold at 0.42, where below which we know that we are guaranteed recovery using L1 minimization. So the blue curve here is, this is for Bernoulli matrices, sorry. The blue curve is upper bounds on the restricted isometric constant computed using this semi-definite relaxation, and the black curve here is lower bounds. You get a solution, you produce a sparse eigenvector, this sparse eigenvector gives you a lower bound of the solution. Okay, and this is typically bad news for the restricted isometric composite. Okay, because remember this number of 20%, 10% I cited, this matrix here has n equal 1,000. Okay, so you would expect sparse recovery up to a threshold of 100. Okay, and you see that here recovery fades at 3 or 4. So the blue line could be something coming from bad performance in the relaxation. But the black line shows that the problem is actually that the constants in the restricted isometric property are bad. Okay, so there are things you can do to improve to improve the quality of these bounds, but you are still an order of magnitude below where we should be. Okay, so the question is now, well, we have these other conditions, the null space property conditions that also guarantee L1 recovery. They're also hard to check, but we can probably produce a convex relaxation to test them efficiently. Okay, and check if their numerical performance is closer to what we observe in practice. Okay, so this is what we try to do. So the null space property, as defined by Donneau and Yo or Cohen and others more recently, well, they simply look at vectors inside the null space of A, as the name indicates. Okay, and basically we're going to say that the matrix A satisfies the null space property if for a certain target cardinality K, there is a constant alpha k that's strictly smaller than 1, okay, such that the L1 norm of a subset of size k of the coefficients of x is always smaller than alpha k times the L1 norm of x. Okay, so you extract, you take a vector in the null space, you extract, for example, the t largest coefficients, compute the L1 norm, and if for every vector, such vector in the null space, this inequality is satisfied, you're guaranteed sparse recovery. Okay? So again, and the results are much easier to prove in some sense than for restricted isometric property. If alpha 2k is smaller than 1, you have guaranteed recovery by solving the combinatorial minimum cardinality problem. And if alpha k is smaller than 1/2, you're guaranteed recovery by solving an L1 minimization problem. And this is not a typo I checked. So with high probability, the K here is correct. Okay? And furthermore, which is somewhat important here, Cohen and others show that if the restricted isometry holds at threshold 2K with a constant delta, then you also get the null space property with constant alpha computed directly from delta, which means that the null space property is a weaker condition than the restricted isometric property. So we can expect it to do a little bit better and produce more realistic results if we can test it numerically. Okay? We don't know by how much, but we know that it's at least weaker. So typically by homogeneity, you can rewrite alpha k in this format. It's a maximization problem. It's non-convex, of course, because of the y transpose x. So all the constraints are convex, but the objective is not. Okay? Y transpose x is a problem. But using the exact same technique, we can produce, again, exact same technique up to this constant, inequality on Z. Okay, we can produce a semi-definite relaxation for this problem here. So, for example, we lift the constraint that A, X is in the kernel of A as this equality constraint on the matrix X. We lift the L1 constraint on X as this L1 constraint, this is the sum of the absolute values of the coefficient of X, as this L1 on the matrix, L1 constraint on the matrix X, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? And so, so that's one way of bounding this condition. And actually, at the same time, Juditsky and Mirovsky last year derived an LP-based relaxation for the same quantity. Okay? The relaxation is different, but essentially they're bounding the same thing using again, a simple duality argument. A few things. So again, this is a semi-definite relaxation. We don't know anything about its performance. The only thing we know is that it's tractable. It's a large-scale semi-definite program, but its complexity is still polynomial in the dimension matter. We can simplify it a little bit using an elimination result for linear matrix inequalities in Boyd, Elgaoui, Ferron, and Balakrishnan. And okay, so you get this smaller minimum eigenvalue maximization problem on a very weird polyhedral norm ball. Okay? So this is interesting from a complexity point of view, but it's not particularly groundbreaking. But the nice byproduct of this transformation is that it shows that the relaxation is rotation invariant. Okay, which is very important because the property itself is we're trying to bound, and the quantities we're trying to bound are also rotation invariant. Okay, so that's a nice result as well. And again, the complexity of computing Euclidean projections on these balls is relatively low because they amount to solving penalized regression problems with L-in-1 and L-infinity norms, so this is relatively nice, and so the total complexity of solving this thing is again N4. But it's a bad N4 in some sense, and we still don't understand why. This is typically slower than the other N4 I showed you by a huge constant. So for first-order methods, there's a much broader gap between practical performance and theoretical complexity bounds, and this is a perfect example of this happening. Okay, so on the other hand, well, at least we can do some experiments, and we can also try to use this relaxation. We get as its solution a covariance matrix, a positive semi-definite matrix, and as in the Max Cut paper by Gumantz and Williamson, we can use this covariance matrix to generate points and try to prove negative results. So this time we generate feasible points, and if we go high enough in the objective value, one of these feasible points might prove that, well, the null space property constant alpha is higher than the certain threshold, 1/2 or 1, actually 1/2. And so typically it's a good idea to use the solution to get these negative certificates as well. And, well, randomization here doesn't work too well, but we can use concentration results to guarantee that the points that we generate are always feasible. So in particular, if we normalize, because this one norm of X when X is Gaussian with covariance matrix X, we have an explicit form for the L1 norm of X, and furthermore, the L1 norm of X is a Lipschitz function of a Gaussian random variable, so we have explicit concentration results for this norm, and so we can guarantee that a normalized version of X will always satisfy the feasibility constraints in the problem, okay? And I told you about this inequality on Z, and this randomization result is actually where the intuition for this penalty on Z came from, because you see that the quality, the standard deviation in some sense of the L1 norm of X is controlled by the sum of the square root of the diagonal coefficients of the matrix X, and you typically want that sum of square roots of diagonal coefficients to be small, okay? And actually, because of positive semi-definiteness of 2x2 block matrices inside the problem matrix, you have this inequality linking the sum of the absolute values of the coefficients of Z and the product of these two square roots of diagonal terms, okay? So typically, you don't want these things to be big, and if you don't want these things to be big, you want to keep this small. And actually, even though this constraint on Z is that we had in the problem is redundant, it helps performance a lot. Okay? So this is, normalizing is a sort of naive way to generate feasible points. Okay? What you would really want to do is generate points where you bound the expectation of the K1 norm of the vector X. Okay? Because this is the real quantity you're interested in. But the problem is that order statistics are a real pain to bound. So in particular, there are relaxations to bound order statistics in the uncorrelated case, but all the information here in our case is contained in the correlation matrix. And so if there is an expert in this room on order statistics and bounds on order statistics in the correlated case, I'll provide unlimited drinks, provided you can guarantee productivity. Because this is really the key problem here. This is why we use this very naive, it sounds like a very naive randomization procedure, but at least it allows you to produce bounds. in particular this one. But it, as we can see here, you get this tightness result, and unfortunately, there's a factor square root of n that you can't eliminate. Okay? So it's good for intuition, but it doesn't really guarantee anything. And I have more negative statements to come. But in practice, numerically, at least for small problems, of course, this is a very large SDP, so it's hard to solve on large programs, but we can do experiments with small matrices. Okay, so here we are going to generate 10 sample Gaussian matrices with leading dimension 40. Okay, and we are going to list median upper bounds. In fact, it doesn't really matter to generate 10 sample Gaussian matrices here because everything is highly concentrated. For each of these problem characteristics, we're going to list median upper bounds on the value of alpha k for various values of the target cardinality k and for the various values of the matrix shape ratios rho, so the how fat, the rho factor that controls how fat the matrix is or how indeterminate the problem is. Okay? And for these Gaussian matrices, we have explicit expressions on both the strong and the weak recovery thresholds in the asymptotic limit that come from the paper by Donohoe and Tanner, so we list them here. Okay, so remember, the point here is if you can show that alpha k for a certain cardinality k is smaller than 1/2, then you can show that you're going to recover all signals that have a cardinality less than k by solving this very easy linear program. Okay? So typically in bold here are all the values of the solution of the relaxation that prove that alpha k is smaller than 1/2. Okay? 0.48 means that if the shape ratio of the matrix is 0.8, so the problem is not that indeterminate, then you can recover all solutions that have, roughly speaking, 4 non-zero coefficients by solving this L1 minimization problem. And what you see is that, well, we get this threshold here of 2, 2, 3, and 4 by solving our relaxation, and the real values, asymptotically, of course, are 2 here and 3 in this case. So we're very close to the real value. Okay, and of course, the weak recovery limit, the area where you don't have almost sure recovery, but you have recovery with high probability is much higher. So what you observe is always much higher than this, but we're really close to the, at least the theoretical threshold. Okay? So this is good news. Unfortunately, there are also limits to how well this can perform. So numerically on these small examples, it does very close to actual numerical performance. And you can even show that the SDP relaxation is tight for alpha 1. So if you try to recover a signal with one non-zero coefficient, you get the optimum solution. So that problem is not very hard. Okay, so this in itself is not a very striking result. However, there's a result by Jedzicki and Niemirovsky which shows that if you can bound alpha 1, then at least, well, you can prove perfect recovery at a cardinality square root of k star if the matrix satisfies the restricted isometry at a threshold k star. So you can do basically square root of the best possible outcome. Okay? And that's because you're tight on alpha 1. And now the negative results, which are also pretty strong, okay? We can show, and there's a very simple counterexample, which is essentially a normalized projection operator, that shows that for any matrix A, so it's not just an instance, it's for any matrix A, we can produce a counterexample where we show that the relaxation cannot do better than this limit of square root of k star whenever the matrix satisfies the restricted isometry at the level k star. Okay, so we're stuck at this threshold square root of k star. It's the same thing for the linear programming relaxation in Jedzicki and Niemirovsky. It cannot do better than square root of k star. And it's also the same thing for the relaxation on sparse eigenvalue for the restricted isometry that I just discussed. So we have three different relaxations for the same problem. Okay? They are completely different. So one is not even testing the same condition. So one is testing a condition on restricted isometry constants. The other two are testing this null space property constant alpha k. Okay? One is a semi-definite relaxation, the other is a linear programming relaxation. They have essentially nothing in common. But all of them are stuck at this level, square root of k star. Okay? So they're all relatively far away from the optimal rate, which should be here, m. Okay? We can do square root of m for any matrix, but we cannot do m. So the good news is that we're not limited anymore to random matrices. If you give me a matrix that satisfies perfect recovery at the restricted isometric property at the level k star, I can, using a convex program, guarantee that it will at least satisfy this sparse recovery condition at a level square root of k star. Okay, the bad news is that testing recovery conditions at the optimal level m, or basically k star, remains a completely open problem. Okay? So what next? Well, there's a certain, the semi-definite relaxations are sort of an R form. Okay? So the lifting is an automatic procedure. Right? But if you do the simple lifting on the null space property relaxation, the performance you get in the end is much worse than the performance you get by adding a redundant constraint on the matrix Z. Okay, so this is where the art comes in. You add redundant constraints. Some of them will help a lot, and some of them won't. And we have no systematic way of producing these extra redundant constraints that improve the relaxation tightness. Okay, so at this point, this is luck and guesswork. And so, also, we're focused a lot on strong recovery, but in practice, people care about weak recovery. They don't care if there's an exponentially small probability of failure. The problem is that we don't know how to test weak recovery thresholds using convex relaxations. And furthermore, you have to agree on what high probability means, etc. So it becomes a personal issue, right? So it's tricky. Maybe we all fail at the same threshold because it's hard to prove recovery beyond the square root of m level. But that would be a sort of negative statement. You just sample a few Gaussian variables and you're guaranteed m, and you try to optimize, you do relaxations, etc., and you're stuck at square root of m. It would sound a little bit counterintuitive. If you work in signal processing, and I'm going to conclude, so this is my last sentence, I promise. It's going to be a long one, but if you work in signal processing, square root of m is not that impressive, okay? Of course, that's a quick analysis of the result, but using mutual incoherence, which is a condition that's about as old as myself, you can show that Gaussian matrices can prove recovery prove recovery using random Gaussian matrices at the level square root of m by just looking at the magnitude of the off-diagonal coefficient. So if you talk to someone in signal processing and tell them that basically you can prove recovery at the level square root of m, they're not going to be that impressed. Of course, here we do much better because we can do it for any matrix, whereas, of course, mutual incoherence only works on random ones. But this square root of m level is sort of frustrating. It's sad not to be able to do better than this, and we should be able to do better than this. Okay? Thank you.